This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In 10 days, voters will go to the polls to elect 150 members in the Vermont House and 30 members in the Vermont Senate. Currently, the Democrats hold sizable majorities in each chamber, and they'd like to keep this advantage. But Republican and Progressive Party leaders are hoping to make significant reductions in the Democratic majorities. What are some of the key issues that the three parties are basing their campaigns on? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today. With us, House Majority Leader Sarah Copeland-Hanzus, also House Minority Leader Don Turner, and Washington Representative Susan Hatch Davis, who is a member of the Progressive Caucus. Welcome to the program. It's great to have all of you here.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What do you think are the top issues in your local legislative race this year? We'd love to hear about that. Do you have competitive races in your district? How closely are you following these races? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So to start off today, I'd like to ask all three of you what the top three issues are for your legislative candidates as you go across the state, issues that reflect the basic priorities of your party. Sarah, what would the three be for the Democrats?
Thanks, Bob. So I've been in contact with 110 candidates who are running as Democrats this year in Vermont. And so we won't come together to actually formalize an agenda and a platform until December, well after the election. But as I'm talking with folks out there, the issues that they're prioritizing really kind of fall into three different categories. One of the main categories is really, you know, tools for working Vermonters. Access to higher ed is critically important. We know that that young people graduating from high school in Vermont are not accessing higher ed at the rates that we would expect them to, given our great high school graduation rate here in Vermont. There are many rural areas that are off the broadband grid, and if you don't have access to broadband in your home community or at your home, it's pretty difficult to start a business, pretty difficult for your kids to do their homework. And if you ever wanted to sell that house, you would have a lot of trouble finding a young family who wanted to come live there. And then other tools for working Vermonters, you know, we really need to think about childcare and family leave. We have workers in Vermont, parents in Vermont who have to make really difficult decisions about being in the workforce. It puts a tremendous strain on families when the cost of childcare isn't proportional to people's incomes, and childcare workers are not being paid well enough. So tools for working Vermonters are really important. Jobs in the environment is another category that I hear people talking about a lot, and you'll see a lot of overlap in this as we talk about this, because you know the jobs of the future will come when we have more folks heading to higher ed after high school. And again, you know, job growth in rural areas can't happen without access to broadband. But really, the big issue for us, I think, is to think about continuing the great work we've done on positioning us for the climate change economy. Our renewables industry has created many new jobs in Vermont, good-paying jobs in Vermont, and has saved Vermonters money on their utility bills. And we want to continue to look for more ways to save for Vermonters.
Susan, what would you say are yours?
Well, the top three issues are establishing and guaranteeing that the minimum wage must be a livable wage. For many decades, the Vermont Progressive Party has been helping and working with many working families and supporting working families. Many folks are working full-time and still living in poverty, and we know that the middle income rose 5% from 2014 to 2015, and it was the first increase since 2007. Even with this increase, real income in 2015 was actually lower than in 1999. And taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing big business. In 2014, Americans for Taxpayer Fairness said that there are 911 Walmart employees receiving about $4 million in public assistance each year. 43% of women in Vermont earn less than the poverty level. The economic situation then translates to lower retirement funds and lower Social Security benefits for women. One out of every six children in Vermont lives in poverty, and half of them live in extreme poverty. This also affects our schools and education. Support for workers is important, and many progressive legislators have stood on the picket lines supporting workers for fair contracts and the right to bargain. Second, I think property taxes. Reduce and remove the residential property tax as the funding base for education. Since my first days in the House, I've been part of several tripartisan coalitions that want to shift school taxes to an income tax. We need to ease property tax burdens so Vermonters can use more of their hard-earned money to meet their basic needs. This session, I co-sponsored Bill H-656, a bill that proposes lowering property tax rates for households earning less than $200,000. In the end, we passed legislation that includes modeling this reform in time for the 2017 session. With any luck, that's something that we will be talking about. A third issue is to discontinue the failed war on drugs. I think this could be the big year for pushing to legalize cannabis our next session. Last week, the Human Rights Watch and the ACLU, the two largest civil rights organizations, released their report detailing the failures on the war on drugs, including the strain that it puts on our judicial and our prison systems, and in effect, it has had on curbing drug use, or the lack thereof. I think it's time to recognize that the war on drugs has failed and take a smarter approach to regulating controlled substances. Prohibition isn't working. People are using marijuana across our state, and I think it's time that we address that.
Don Turner, what would be your top three priorities?
Well, thank you, Bob. Earlier this month, our caucus held a press conference at the State House on the front steps, and we outlined our goals and what we're hearing. We have about 100 candidates out there working diligently to get elected to the legislature this year. And our top priority is cost of living. We have heard not only this election cycle, but also the previous election cycle, about how much it costs to live in this state, and people just can't afford it. So that's our number one issue. And that includes goals not to increase or raise any taxes, unlike the majority, who has raised $95.3 million in new taxes in the last 2 years alone. We're proposing not to increase or raise any new taxes in this next biennium. Along with cost of living is health care. We have health care costs rising dramatically as far as insurance, the Vermont Health Exchange fees. We've got to address cost of living issues. So that's our number one issue, would be cost of living issues and getting those under control so we can sustain it and people can continue to live in Vermont. Our number two issue would focus on education. We want to improve student outcomes, and we believe strongly that removing school choice is going to be a detriment to people who have chosen to live in certain parts of Vermont because of school choice. Under the last biennium, that was removed, and that is being destroyed in Vermont. We need to restore that. But our focus is on student outcomes and education, along with property taxes. So we have to do a better job in our education system in paying for the education that our kids get. But we want student outcomes to be first and foremost. And our third issue is to really scour regulatory prohibitions on business. We know that we need to grow the economy in order to sustain much of what the state offers. However, many of our current laws are negative. They are not business friendly. So we are going to look at the regulatory reform to allow for more business opportunities and then create predictable business-friendly laws to move forward. So those will be our top three priorities, Bob.
Today in the program, we're looking at the legislative priorities for the Democratic Party, the Progressive Party, and the Republican Party. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Maroney, who is calling from Montpelier. Hi, Maroney. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I'm really happy to hear candidates talking about affordability. And one of the things as I travel to the state, talking to parents is the affordability of childcare. And a recent survey indicates that 83% of Vermonters want to prioritize high-quality childcare. And I'd just like to hear what all the candidates have to say, if elected, how would they address this issue, and not just statewide, but also in their region.
Okay, thanks for your question. Sarah, you mentioned that as one of your top three. You mentioned child care and family leave. What needs to be done?
So I think the first thing that we need to do is to really take a look at our child care infrastructure. I hear from child care providers in my community about how difficult it is for them to make ends meet, and they don't feel like they can raise their rates because the parents who are working for them are not making enough money as it is. When I was in my early 30s and staying home with my kids, it was a time of really economic hardship for our family, but the economics of using 75 or 80% of my paycheck to pay for daycare for our three kids didn't make a whole lot of sense. And so we scraped and scrounged and made ends meet in order to avoid that that expense to our family. But when one family member has to take time away from their career, studies show that person oftentimes doesn't regain the upward mobility that they had if they hadn't had to take months or years off of their career. And so, I think we should ask these questions as a state about do we want to talk about how workers might fund their own family leave program so that I could pay in my teens and 20s into a system that would then benefit me when I decide it's time to have kids. I think these are questions that Vermonters are asking, and I think it makes a lot of sense for us to pursue a paid family leave system that Vermonters would fund themselves.
Under that proposal, would employers have a responsibility as well?
Well, I'm not necessarily referring to a specific proposal. I think as a small business owner and as a mom who has been through this, I would want to balance both sides of that question. So is it important to me as a mom that other parents don't have to go through the struggles that I did when my children were little? Yeah. And as a business owner, do I want to be given an automatic bill to help my workers pay for childcare? I don't know. But my workers might want to set up a system where they can pay for that for themselves, and I think we should be open to that conversation.
Don Turner, what do you think about paid family leave?
I do not believe that we can afford to expand any more burdens on businesses. Small businesses, we've heard all along, are struggling. Well, I think to answer your caller's question, one of the things that the state has spends millions of dollars in assisting in child care for many children around the state. But one of the things we've also done, I believe, is we've overregulated it. I, unfortunately, with my three daughters, we had an in-home daycare child care provider is like a third grandmother to my kids. Well, today, under the new regulations, she'd be put out of business. I have heard from many people in the last 3 months about how they're closing these child care centers, the small, person, two, three people centers, because they can't meet the regulations the state and the burdens the state has put on them. So I think we have to really look at that and we have to rescind some of those regulatory hurdles that people are facing and allow these small child care centers to stay open and allow people to do what they want with their kids at an affordable rate.
Susan, how do the progressives feel about paid family leave?
The progressives support paid family leave, and I would like to talk about in my area, I know that affordable child care is very much needed. It used to be in the days, I know when I first started working, that my mom was my daycare provider. But in many cases now, the moms are working and the grandmothers are working, so that doesn't work. So we need to look at how can we help working families today to be able to afford and to find quality daycare. And I think that also ties back to wages. It makes it tough to raise the rates at child care centers when we have workers who are barely making their basic needs and struggling to get by on their paychecks. And I don't, you know, maybe one suggestion that they could the workers could do something to help themselves in the future to pay for child care works. But right now, most people are struggling just to meet their basic needs, and I don't see them being able to save to do something like that in their future.
Today on the program, we're looking at some of the issues being discussed and debated in legislative districts all across the state. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about some tax issues. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, we're looking at some of the issues in legislative races across the state. With us today, House Minority Leader Don Turner, Washington Representative Susan Hatch Davis, a member of the Progressive Caucus, and also House Majority Leader Sarah Copeland-Hansis. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Susan, you mentioned in one of your priorities property tax reform. And I think you said that you want to move away from using property taxes altogether to fund education. Does that mean that you want to rely more heavily on the income tax for that purpose?
Yes, it does mean that. And for a long time, since I first ran for the legislature, I've been interested in moving to an income-based solution. And this year I was hopeful when I signed on to a bill, a co-sponsored bill that would help to move us away from the property tax. And so next session I think we will be talking even more about the property taxes moving to an income-based tax that's been introduced by our Senator Anthony Polina.
And some people who don't like this idea would say that the income tax is far too volatile. If you went back to 2007, 2008, 2009, when income tax revenues just plummeted in the state, that the rates for the income taxes would have had to skyrocket in order to support education. How do you address those concerns?
Well, I think that when we're talking about volatility, I think property rates and the market is just as volatile. And I think that one thing that we need to look at the income, using the income, is because it could be adjusted as the volatility changed.
Don Turner, what do you think of switching over to the income tax to pay for education? Right now, about two-thirds of all homeowners in Vermont do that, in fact, because they're part of income sensitivity. So how about making everybody do that?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. We wouldn't support that initially. The main reason is we believe that we have to get the cost of education under control before we even explore shifting to a new revenue stream. We do, though, believe that we need a new funding mechanism for education in Vermont, and we will be happy to look into that or move in a direction that may look at that. People today that make under $130,000 already have their property taxes paid based on income, and that is a big number. It is allowing for a lot of people to vote positive on school budgets that don't have the same financial impact as many others. So we're very concerned about that. We believe that we need to reconnect the voter, the taxpayer, to the real cost of the school budgets. And one way we've done that, the state has just commissioned a study a year or so ago that shows that we spend about $160 million more than we need to for the outcomes we're getting. So I believe that we have to tie the cost, and we want better student outcomes. So if we want better student outcomes, we better figure out a better way to utilize the resources that are in the education system and then look at ways of funding it from that point. So again, I would not support a move to a solely income-based tax at this point.
Don, do you think our current system of income sensitivity is too generous, that it should be scaled back in terms of people's salaries and whether or not they qualify for the program?
Absolutely. I think that more people have to have skin in this property tax game, and that's what's driving the cost up at the pace it has over the last few years. You know, we have put forth a number of bills. We put forth a bill that would ban school districts from enforcing or putting in place a contract, as well as banning teacher strikes. So we believe that we got to deal with cost in that manner. The other thing that we looked at was a statewide teacher's contract. We put forward a bill that has never been really looked at. So we'd like to see those things explored before we look at transitioning to a different source of revenue.
And, sir, how do the Democrats feel about this idea of shifting 100% to folks' income to pay for education?
Well, I think you've identified one of the main concerns with shifting to 100% income-based school funding, and that is the volatility of the income tax. And so I think that we would be more inclined to pursue models that would be more of a hybrid, perhaps expanding income sensitivity. You know, the $130,000 that Don referenced, you know, that's two school teachers, or that's a school teacher and a firefighter. These are not wealthy people who are, spending weekends on their yacht in the Caribbean. These are hardworking Vermonters. And to have them fall off income sensitivity at the same time that they're probably trying to plan for saving for their kids' college really puts a lot of Vermont families in great hardship. I don't disagree with Don that we need to get costs under control first. But I think the way you do that is not by – the way you do that without negatively impacting student outcomes is not by setting up a system where more school budgets fail. It's by – asking the school districts to come together and find efficiencies and work with their neighbors to find those economies of scale that many school systems are doing now under Act 46.
So Don said he'd like to restrict the eligibility and income sensitivity because he feels that more people need to be connected to their local school budgets. Are you saying you'd like to expand it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, $100,000, $120,000, these are middle-income Vermonters, and that would be a tax increase for them.
Susan?
Yes, I'd like to respond to partly Don's comments. Years ago, in order to cushion the middle class from property taxes, that income sensitivity for incomes under $90,000 it was based on their income. Under the new law, a family would not have to pay more than 2 or 3% of their income in education taxes. And people making more than $90,000 were allowed to escape this provision then, and that's because at higher income levels, taxpayers tend to pay less on their property if they are paying on their property's value than they are if they're paying on their income. So if we were to move to a system based on income, and getting the numbers from the tax department shows that people earning between $300,000 and $400,000 tend to pay about 2% of their income in education property taxes. People earning $500,000 tend to pay about 1%. People earning $1 million pay about 0.5%. So meanwhile, support for our education from the general fund has fallen from about 40% to about 19%, placing a greater burden on our property tax payers, particularly middle class. So I am in favor of looking at using an income-based system.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Thomas from North Troy. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's no doubt that the high prices of healthcare are astronomical and they're being felt by everybody, whether you're paying taxes or you're paying the hospital bill. The problem, I think, lies is having the options to affordable healthcare, such as contacting your doctor. Your doctor says, I'm sorry, we cannot see you today. You're going to have to go to the emergency room. Well, up here in the Northeast Kingdom, there is not a walk-in clinic offered at the hospital. You know, if we're going to pay these people through funding of the Medicare and Medicaid programs, they should be coming up with options to lower the price of the burden of the taxpayers.
Okay, Thomas, we appreciate your phone call, and that can segue right into Vermont Health Connect and what should happen with Vermont Health Connect. It's no secret that the state's healthcare exchange has had its share of problems. More than $200 million in state and federal money has been spent on the exchange. So what's the future of it? Should it be fixed in some way or just dump it and join the federal exchange? Don, what do you think?
Well, that's a very tough question. And I think, you know, as we move forward, I think we're going to see a lot more information on how we're going to have to move forward there. I believe that we need to get to close Vermont Health Exchange as it is. Initially, though, my thoughts are that we would eliminate the mandates. You know, right now the state requires people to buy health insurance on the exchange, which isn't working. We know it's not working. I have a constituent of mine right now who's suffering, and I'm trying to help her get through that. So we know that's not working. So we need to move away from Vermont Health Connect. And I think that eventually we'll have maybe a system, an exchange that is a multi-state. Maybe it is the federal exchange. But we do have, the state has spent almost $300 million on this platform that Vermont Health Exchange operates on. It does serve our Medicaid population, which is very important, and Vermont does a very good job with its Medicaid population. So we need to have that going forward no matter what we do with the exchange. So at this point, we can't afford the Vermont Health Exchange the way it is. It's $52 million a year. The feds pay some right now, and the state pays a lot of it. We are not going to be able to sustain that going forward. So that's going to have to be – we're going to have to do something going – pretty soon we're going to deal with that. And I think it's a combination of a multi-state type project, something like Hawaii, maybe something with Connecticut or some of the other Northeast states. So that's what I believe, that we will be going away from Vermont Health Connect in the very near future, simply because of cost, and the program just does not work.
Don, you know, people who think that moving to the federal exchange is a bad idea would say right now a lot of middle-income Vermonters on the exchange get subsidies, and they have lower out-of-pocket expenses as well. So they say if you move to the federal exchange, you're going to end up raising costs on the people who can least afford to pay those costs. So how do you respond to that?
Well, we're going to raise costs on somebody, and my goal would be to not burden the state on any additional cost and continue to help those people. The federal exchange is not the answer, is not the sole answer, and I totally understand that. But we're providing those subsidies via the state now. We could provide a lot of subsidies with the $52 million that it costs to operate Vermont Health Connect, and that would be my answer.
Sarah, what do you think the future of Vermont Health Connect is?
So Don isn't wrong when he says that this is really complicated. We have been sitting frustrated for several years now as we get calls from our neighbors who are having trouble enrolling in healthcare. And it has really made a lot of us feel like we're frustrated and ready to throw in the towel. I wouldn't advocate doing anything that would threaten the premium subsidy and help with copays and out-of-pocket expenses that Vermonters rely on right now. And, you know, I think that what I would have us do is really double down on our focus on IT oversight in the legislature so that as we look at ways we're investing in technology like this, we have members of the citizen legislature who are up to speed and can give good oversight to how we invest in IT going forward.
Don said he'd like to see it be a voluntary program and not have it be mandated. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, the Affordable Care Act requires people to carry insurance. And, you know, Vermont's insurance pool is small enough as it is that it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to split that pool into different areas. There are many mandates within the Affordable Care Act that we simply have no control over because they're federal law. And I think that what makes more sense for us going forward is to continue to support the work that doctors are doing in finding better and more affordable ways to provide that care.
Susan, what are your thoughts about Vermont Health Connect? Should it be scrapped? What's its future?
Well, the Vermont Health Connect or the exchange has been a big disappointment from it seems like from day one. And I know folks out in my community have called me often, and I've helped family and friends to try to get enrolled and then found out that after they were enrolled, they might not be covered. So there have been many disappointments with Vermont Health Connect, but there have been many folks who have been satisfied with it. And I think that the IT implementation has been a bear. It's led me to wonder if there have been some sort of mitigation strategies along the way. If there was a problem, what they might do, you know, would you exit? Would you go this way? What would you do? So last session, the legislature actually passed language where our joint fiscal office has hired an outside group to come in and take a look at what we might do, come up with options, alternatives. And so I am waiting to see the report come back that is due. I think it's due in November, and that will be very helpful to legislators to see what's available from an independent study and move forward from there.
Today in the program, we're looking at some of the legislative priorities in this election. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we have three guests on the program's legislative leaders. We have House Majority Leader Sarah Copeland-Hanzus. We have Washington Representative Susan Hatch Davis, a member of the Progressive Caucus, and also House Minority Leader Don Turner. We're looking at some of the issues in the races this year. Your thoughts, what are the issues that you'd like to see lawmakers consider in the election in the next 10 days? 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number. Let's turn to John in Richmond. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, John. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm listening to the legislators talk about their various positions and proposals, and I realize this is before the election, and my question kind of deals with what happens after the election. And I haven't heard much at any level people talking about governing. And there are diametrically opposed positions just in the three folks talking today. And I'm wondering how do the various people intend to govern with the folks who may not agree with how to get there. I guess the question is, have they talked about common goals? Have they talked about, you know, where to take the state and communicated that to the general populace so we can help in the decision making? Right now, it's us versus them times three.
Okay, John, great question. Sarah, what about some of John's concerns?
I appreciate the question because I think that something that often doesn't get covered by the news media is the extent to which we come together and collaborate when we get to Montpelier. You know, the Vermont House is made up of passionate and committed Vermonters who come from all corners of the state. And we have a culture in the House of strong committee process that puts 11 people in a room in a facilitated dialogue about how to solve the problem at hand. And when you look at the number of bills that get signed into law that came out of their originating committee, 11 to nothing or 9 to 2, it really demonstrates that there is a lot of compromise, there's a lot of collaboration, there's a lot of listening to the concerns of everyone in that room. And I think that a lot of times the committees are set up to really kind of check your party affiliation at the door and come in with the mindset of solving problems for all Vermonters. And I'm proud of that culture in the House and proud to, as a majority leader, to have been able to facilitate that culture.
Don, how much collaboration do you think goes on in the House?
I have to disagree with Sarah and that, you know, there's been single party rule in Montpelier for the last 6 years, and the majority controls who's on which committee, how many people are in each committee, and the speaker essentially controls the agenda. I do recognize that there are many bills. Last year, there were 1,155 bills introduced, 199 passed, and 174 were signed by the governor. And a lot of those bills did receive tripartisan support. But the major issues are controlled by the majority. And they dictate how these bills are going to be brought up in committee, who's going to testify on behalf, and very few against. And that's how the process works. But that's how it was designed to work. That's why this election is so important. We have had single-party rule in this state, Democrat rule, with large majorities for the last 6 years. It's so important that people get out this election. If they're not happy with the direction of the state, then it's time for a change. Elect new people to go to Montpelier is the only way you're going to get different outcomes than we've had in the last 6 years.
Susan, there are 150 members of the Vermont House. The Progressive Caucus has 6 members. I know you'd like to add to that come November. How is your caucus effective? What makes your caucus have a voice that gets heard?
I think that we are a small caucus, but we are a loud voice for the issues that we are interested in. And we are issues-based, and we look at the issue, and we can speak to the issue. And in answering part of the caller's question, I thought that the caller had talked about how we get our message out to our constituency and what we do in Montpelier and talk with our constituency. I know that during the election cycle, I go door to door, and I know many progressives go door to door. That's our grassroots is one of the best ways to get elected and to talk with our constituents so that they can be informed about what we're doing and so that we can be informed of what their issues and that they're interested in, and then we can bring them back to Montpelier. And I think I should say that we have 150 members, and not one person can pass a bill. It takes compromise. It takes working together. And we may all push buttons in different ways, but in the end, in order to pass a bill, it means that we all must work together.
You know, there are a number of large-scale size wind projects being considered around the state. We've gotten a lot of calls about that in previous programs, and the question really being, how much authority should local communities have in this debate that is very divisive in some towns? Susan, what do you think? Do you think towns should have veto power over the siting of these large-scale wind projects?
I think that towns should definitely have say in the siting of these in their towns. And I know that I have been involved with my town, not only to deal with wind, but also with cell towers and their locations. I definitely think towns should have some say in where we're placing things within our town boundaries.
When you say some say, what do you mean? I mean, when a case goes before the Public Service Board, right now with the new law, towns can have substantial deference, and particularly if they, I think they have to adhere to a planning process. Some say sounds a little squishy.
Well, the town's planning process will have to adhere to the regional planning, and so I don't know that all town plans would adhere to the regional planning at this time. But I know that I've worked with select board members from one of my towns who was trying to work with the public service board regarding a cell tower siting in their town, and they've had to work on their town plan since then and work with the regional planning commissions as well.
Sarah, you look at the law that just passed the legislature concerning this issue. Do you think that goes far enough?
I believe that it does. I believe it sets up a system whereby local communities can have appropriate input in what happens within their borders, but does not squash the possibility of development of renewable energy projects in the future. You know, I think it's important for us to recognize that this collective goal that we all agreed upon of moving away from the natural gas or coal or nuclear-fired electricity system and moving to a system of distributed generation where we're making more of our own power here is one that we all agree on. You know, we save money when we generate our own electricity on our rooftops or in backyard wind or even in some of the larger solar fields or wind projects in Vermont. I think it's right to make sure that Vermonters feel like it's being done on a Vermont scale and in a Vermont way. And so I think that we have struck a balance, and I would like to see that play out for a while before we make any major changes to renewable siting in Vermont.
Don, what are your thoughts about this issue?
Well, first I want to correct Sarah. We did not all agree on the energy plan that is part of the state's plan at this point. I believe firmly that we need a balanced energy portfolio that does continue to embrace and encourage renewables, but we need baseload power, and we do need fossil fuel for some of our energy needs. We should not make it so people cannot afford fossil fuel by implementing a carbon tax, which would be a significant increase in impact on Vermonters. And we should restore independence to our communities. The bill that the governor forced through with renewable energy does not go far enough from my perspective or many of our caucus members. We want Vermonters, we want to restore independence in their communities. We want to restore independence in their lives. And we think that they should have a say in what's going on with their neighborhoods and their communities. So that is not that's not a representation of what I believe in or many of our caucus members. The carbon tax, for example, every time the majority Democrats proposed this last year at 88 cents, every time you went to fill up your car, it would cost you, if you had a 20-gallon tank, $17.60. If you drove 2,000 miles a year, you'd be looking at approximately $1,300 a year more to drive back and forth to work. Vermonters are already saying they can't afford to live in our state, yet the majority is trying to add more taxes and cost of living in their life. The most frustrating thing for me, Bob, is that these tax increases that we've heard about, that have been going on for the last 6 years and driving people out of our state, we have Democrats out there right now campaigning on that they're going to lower taxes, but they've been voting for them year after year after year. We need a change in Montpelier. We need more Republicans, more Vermont Republicans elected this cycle.
Sarah.
Thank you. So I'm glad that Don brought up the carbon tax because actually, as we've been hearing on the campaign trail, it is indeed mostly members of his party who are talking about it. And I think they've done this intentionally to bring up a bill that was basically declared dead on arrival 2 years ago in the legislature and resurrect it as a drumbeat against Democrats. Look, Vermont alone isn't going to stem the increase in carbon in the global atmosphere. But what we can do more of is what we have done with our renewable energy sector, and that is invest in the strategic thinking and investments necessary to move us away from fossil fuel. The most forward-thinking businesses in Vermont right now are already planning for this figure, for this future, and they've already figured it out. So you look at Seventh Generation or Black River Produce, or even my own family business, Copeland Furniture, who has put in a solar array to help defray the costs of energy. We can't keep our heads in the sand on this.
Well, it's been a great discussion of many of the issues being discussed in legislative races around the state. Many thanks to our guests today, Susan Hatch Davis, Sarah Copeland Hansis, and Don Turner. Thank you all very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.